W1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Daria Aldinger. A simple question and answer session with Donald Trump that was moderated by ABC's Rachel Scott became contentious as the former president repeated his claim he's done more for black Americans than any president since the Civil War.
I have been the best president for the black population since Abraham Lincoln.
Better than President Johnson, who signed the Voting Rights Act.
Vice President Harris on the campaign trail in Houston.
So in this moment, our fundamental freedoms are on the ballot, and so is our democracy.
Harris speaking at a gala for an historically black sorority. A 17-year-old is now charged with murder in a stabbing attack which killed three young girls in Southport, England. He also faces 10 counts of attempted murder. The Pentagon says three of the five 9/11 defendants at Guantanamo Bay, including alleged mastermind Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, reached plea deals. This is ABC News.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news roundup in quick podcast form. You can find it anywhere at the WGBW website, wgbw.fm.
Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. A man who stabbed a teenager to death tubing in the Apple River 2 years ago is going to prison. More from James Kelly.
Nikolai Mew was convicted of first-degree reckless homicide and four counts of recklessly endangering safety following an eight-day trial in St. Croix County. On Wednesday, he was sentenced to serve a total of 20 years in prison and 6 years extended supervision. Mew was arrested following the July 2022 incident where he stabbed five people on the river, killing 17-year-old Isaac Schumann in the process. I'm James Kelly.
Vice President Kamala Harris and her running mate plan to stop in western Wisconsin next week. Harris is expected to announce her running mate by Tuesday. That's when they'll be at a rally in Philadelphia. They'll campaign in seven swing states in 4 days after that. That's what you need to know. I'm Terry Bell, and this is Civic Media News.
The Maggie Dawn Show.
Milwaukee County Board Chairwoman Marcelia Nicholson.
The moment I walked out of the auditorium, I said, it's our time now. It's the little girls that look like me who wake up with brown skin and sometimes wonder, do they matter? To have someone like Kamala, who is not only qualified, but representative of voices that have been ignored for far too long, it felt like all things are possible.
The Maggie Dawn Show. Weekdays from 2 till 4 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to, lots to talk about. The decision, going to be soon, evidently before August 7th. Vice President Kamala Harris is going to make her choice be known. Who is going to be the VP candidate? A lot of folks thrilled with Tim Walz, the guy from Minnesota. A lot of people want the astronaut from Arizona. Kelly, people like me want Buttigieg, again, for the reason that you, that debate, just the debate with Vance, is enough for me. But I think Buttigieg is the perfect messaging guy, bright, articulate, quick on his feet, and generally tears into Fox News. So somebody that you want, who's going to bring in, I think some middle ground people, but we'll see where the grand choice is. This, the first decision. And for me, every presidential nominee, that first decision is the one that tells me which way are they going to go. How well are they going to do? Is Kamala Harris going to pick somebody who's going to be young, exciting, somebody who's old, exciting, or someone who's, well, very forgettable? And we'll see. And it's going to say a lot about, in my view, a lot about who she is as a leader. If she picks somebody young, energetic, somebody old, energetic, somebody who's got, you know, some chops. It's going to tell me she got the confidence to take that on. Generally, you take somebody who's milk toast. I don't know. We'll see. But understand, the love affair continues. Polls going in the right direction. The new Susquehanna poll in my state of Pennsylvania shows Kamala up on Donald Trump 47-43. And not only her, but in the Senate race has pulled that up for Casey leading over McCormick 47-42. So not only is it possible that you could pull the electoral votes for a presidential win, going to hold on to a seat that Republicans were getting a little excited about. The potential of making Pennsylvania a red state was on their mind. We'll see. Now, how the Republicans are responding, they're responding like they do. The attacks on her have nothing to do with her leadership values, have nothing to do with her policies, have nothing to do with what she's going to do as president. All seem personal. And realistically, it's all they have because they don't have any policies to really run on. And understand the Democratic excitement right now, especially among young people, off the charts. And I've talked to some people who believe this is going to rival 2008. So, Donald, because the weird thing is while Republicans were beating up on Democrats for, you know, for calling for Joe to step aside, there's now calls for Trump to pick another VP. And I've even heard some people say, maybe Trump should go. Now, of course, going to be too late. There's no way that's going to happen. Convention's over. It's in place. But the fact that they're second guessing, the fact that they're looking over their shoulder, bodes well for Kamala Harris and whomever the VP choice is going to be. And look, we're going to see a lot of the racial attacks, a lot of the gender attacks, a lot of the, you know, she slept her way to the top, a lot of that stuff. And understand, you know, they're not going to be coy about it. They are, you know, right out in front. You know, she's the DEI candidate. No, she was a qualified senator. She won an election. She was VP for 3.5 years. It meant something. Now, I look at Laura Trump, Lara. The Republican Party co-chair and Trump's daughter-in-law. She compared Kamala Harris to a trash bag. That's the level of from the RNC. Now, this is the official spokesperson for the freaking RNC. She said, quote, of Kamala Harris, it reminds me of there was a bag that was very famous designer designed. This was several years ago. It was literally a trash bag, but they sold the thing for like $2,000 thinking people would actually buy it. Similar situation with Kamala Harris. Similar. And my first thought was, you know, when you think trash bag, you know, I mean, is this dog whistle too? Because here's the thing, you know, even J.D. Vance back in 2017, and this video has resurfaced, said that, look, the reason that Trump won was racism. He said, look, racism's always going to play a role in our country. And that, you know, some of Trump's voters were racist. And that's true. There's no denying that. There's no arguing that. Now, I've said a number of times that I don't think racism was the only reason. It was there. There was a policy idea. There was something there that got people's attentions and their hopes and their dreams. And he failed on those. He doesn't have that now. All they've got is the anger, the grievance, the racism, the misogyny, the hatred. That's all that's there. There's no, hey, we're going to bring jobs back because they didn't while they were there. There was no, hey, we're going to rebuild for the future. They didn't. So the record, and this is my problem, the record that we lived through, we saw what happened. He did nothing. Had no plans, had no ideas. The healthcare plan was a blank sheet of paper. He was going to repeal and replace Obamacare with something great called nothing, called pay or die. So it's going to be an interesting election. And I've got friends who are saying blowout, expect an electoral blowout. I'm not going there yet, but the energy level is really, really high. Now, on the other side, you've got the Heritage Foundation's guy who's the director of the Project 2025, this guy, Paul Danz. Paul has stepped down. Yeah, and now who knows where he's going? Maybe he got a more lucrative gig. Maybe he's going to be in the Trump cabinet. There's a lot of talk about who the Trump cabinet's going to be and a lot of jockeying to be considered one of the very best people to mismanage our government. But he has stepped down. And I don't know if that's because Trump has, you know, kind of, you know, run away from Project 2025, or if it's just as bad as everyone knows it is, and he doesn't want to get blamed for it. I'm not quite sure, but it is interesting. But when Trump calls it a plan that is seriously extreme and conceived by the severe right, when Trump is running from it, even he knows it's bad. Now, it's going to be the game plan, because they've done an incredible job, and give the Heritage Foundation's money and the 110 groups that came together to put this disastrous idea together. Give them credit. You know, they're telling us, they're delivering the pitch. They're telling us what they want to do to this country. And it is, well, destroy everything that we take and hold dear. Understand that. And you can read it. It's online. It's you can search it by keywords. I suggest you do, especially the labor parts, because for my labor friends, they're coming for you. They're coming for you. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick at therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break. When we come back, gonna talk about the president's ideas on the Supreme Court. Back after this.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So a new Gallup poll out says Americans not really thrilled with their Supreme Court. The nine in robes, not with really high approval ratings. It's been that way since 2021, where the approval rating of the court has dipped below half. And right now, just 43% of Americans approve of how our Supreme Court is doing its job. Almost a record low. And what you have Republicans really happy, killed off abortion. Democrats really sad. Independents, however, breaking the way towards sad, which, again, the reason we seem to be underwater. And where do we go? What do we do? And what has President Biden done? Well, on Monday, they have put out the idea of we're going to hold presidents accountable. They're going to go for term limits. And that's something that should attract my right-wing friends. And a code of ethics. And here to share some thoughts on the big press conference on Monday that they held supporting this, I've asked Megan Hatcher-Mays to come talk with us. She's a senior advisor with United for Democracy, unitedfordemocracy.us, their website, if you want more information. Megan, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks for having me.
So Supreme Court, not overly well-liked. And no. The president says, hey, we're going to come out with this idea, term limits, doing away with that presidential immunity stuff, code of ethics, all sounds great. Tell me about it.
It is great. Yeah, it's really great. You know, Joe Biden is somebody who is a longtime believer in our institutions. And so he doesn't make a lot of, huge moves in any direction, because I think he really has a lot of faith that our institutions will bear out. But we're in a situation now where the institution that's supposed to be the bedrock of our democracy, the Supreme Court, the one that's supposed to protect all of our rights and protect our democracy, is really being led by an ultra right-wing supermajority that is driving, our policies rightward, but it's also giving itself a lot of power to make decisions about, just like you said, abortion, clean air, clean water. They've the Supreme Court, the supermajority, has granted themselves the right to decide whether or not congressional laws.
They've given themselves king status. Good.
That's correct. Yeah,
we will now have 10 kings if Trump gets elected. In the robes, and then the one dressed in orange.
Yeah. So it really got to a point. And then, by the way, while they're doing all of this, while they're rolling back our fundamental constitutional rights, they're being feted by these right wing billionaires who are, you know, lavishing them with gifts and trips to Bali on private jets and, you know, these fancy weekends and the Catskills and, tuition for their families and all that fun stuff.
But Megan, those are just friends. That's what friends do for each other.
Sure. Just the other day, my friend flew me on a private jet to Alaska.
This is why I keep saying I need new friends.
I know. I really don't have the right. I went into the wrong line of business for sure. So it's just a bad look. And just like you were saying, independents and some Republicans actually find this really kind of gross that they would roll back our rights back basically back to the 18th century and celebrate it on fancy yachts and planes and stuff. Like, it's really quite gross. And it got the attention of Joe Biden finally, where he basically was like, this can't continue. The Supreme Court is the only federal court that is not required to follow an enforceable ethics code. Every other federal judge has to follow one, and they don't. The Chief Justice John Roberts earlier this year tried to get around it by saying, oh, well, I'll implement our own code of ethics. Please don't, Congress, don't pass one. You don't have to do that. We'll establish our own. Of course, it's not enforceable at all. And none of the justices have to, nothing happens if the justices don't comply with this ethics code that he invented. So it's fake. So they just kind of get to do whatever they want. And at our expense, at the American people's expense. So it's really, really good news that Joe Biden has decided to say this cannot continue for the sake of our democracy. They, at the very least, need to follow an enforceable ethics code. There should be term limits on these justices so that, you know, who controls the court isn't based on sort of like luck of the draw. It should be just part of the normal order of business where the president gets to pick a new Supreme Court justice. The first and third years of their presidency are every 2 years. And then finally, he announced support for an amendment or a bill that would overturn this really horrible Supreme Court ruling from back in June, Trump versus United States, which basically gave the president immunity from criminal prosecution for any laws that they might break while in office, which is wild.
That's interesting to me. That one right there, that decision right there. If he can do anything he wants, can he just lock up the 9 Supreme Court or 6 Supreme Court
well,
justices?
Yeah, if it was like an official act, that's what they said. If it's part of his official duties as president, he can kind of do whatever he wants. I mean, if you read the dissent in that case, basically, you know, that's what the liberal justices were saying. It's like, where do you draw the line? I mean, you could theoretically have a president saying, well, as an official act, I want to poison my entire cabinet. And there's nothing that the law can do about that, according to this opinion. And the same is kind of true to what you're talking about as well. It's like, well, one of the official acts of the presidency is nominating a Supreme Court justice. Could it be an official act to just imprison the 3 to 6 you don't like? I mean, it's really an appalling ruling.
I mean, you really only need 2.
That's
not right. But, you know, but here's the thing. And look, you know, I know there was a lot of excitement about this, and maybe I'm just a little jaded.
Sure.
Maybe you can help me here, because I know you guys are excited about this. I saw the press conference was great. It, you know, hey, we're gonna finally take on this court that's screwing people over. I don't ever see in my lifetime a constitutional amendment added to our Constitution. The bars are incredibly high, and on purpose, so that you don't have wild swings. I get it, but it just seems like in this day and age, getting to 290 House members and 67 senators and 3/4 of the state, I don't know, that seems like a Herculean leap that there's no one capable of doing.
I think that's totally fair to feel that way. I mean, it's difficult enough to even get a bill passed to raise the minimum wage. I mean, that hasn't happened in, what, 15 years or something like that? Yeah. So I think it's fair to feel jaded and feel concerned about the feasibility of some of these reforms, in particular a constitutional amendment. But I think what's really valuable is that it makes a difference if the president himself is talking about the importance of these reforms. That expands the universe of what is possible. Maybe that's not a constitutional amendment, but that could mean that now Congress has a permission structure to start paying more attention to the court and looking at ways that they can reform the court that you could get passed with a simple majority in the Senate or in the House. Obviously, in the meantime, we need to make sure you're like electing presidents who don't want to commit crimes while they're the president, just as like an extra backstop, a little extra security. Yeah.
But don't crime. That's good advice.
Something to think about.
It's stuff I tell my kids. But here's the thing, and this is where I think you see the value in this. It's the messaging. Like a lot of things during election years. You put out legislation to show your value, your values, and a direction you want to go. My problem with this, and again, I may sound like Debbie Downer here, but you know, it's like a lot of things Democrats do. They go just so far. There's so much more that we should be talking about this. I'm a big fan of expanding the court. Mm-hmm. There are 13 district courts. There should be 13 justices. That just makes it for the sake of symmetry, makes it logical. But there's so many things that we could be doing that we kind of took the meagerest of the reforms and put that out there. Or am I just wrong?
No, you're not wrong. But I think what's happening here is that, well, a couple things. One is there is no one Supreme Court reform that's going to fix every problem. These things need to happen kind of together. Term limits is a good long-term solution to some of the problems we see with the court, which is that there are strategic retirements and then when somebody is nominated, the temperature is so hot for these confirmation hearings that, you know, people are being accused of the wildest stuff in the Judiciary Committee. All of that stuff, the temperature needs to be turned way down for that. So that's like a longer term reform. No, the ethics code is one that obviously we need, given that the justices we have now are really not interested in ethics as a concept. So that's like a current reform. Some of these other reforms like expansion and there are other like broader ethics reforms that I think go a lot farther, like establishing an ethics office in the Supreme Court. Congress has one. Maybe the court should have one too. Those are sorts of things that I think come with this conversation. It's like you have to start somewhere. The fact that Biden has gotten to term limits and ethics reform really can't be discounted, because as of 6 months ago, he was not there on either of those things.
No, look, this is a big deal.
It's a huge deal, but that's how we get from point A to point B. That's how you get from these sort of smaller reforms to this bigger conversation, is because you have to start to introduce the idea to people that no one thing is going to do it. We really need to be looking at a legislative package of reforms that very well could include expansion. And I think that right now we're in a situation where reforms like expansion, which some people might say is like, oh, that'll never happen, it's way too extreme, that's only true kind of inside of Congress. Actually, expansion is a lot more popular among voters than it is among members of Congress. So this street kind of goes two ways. On the one hand, you want to hear the president talking about court reforms, even if, in your view, they're kind of on the smaller side, smaller potatoes. And then our job as advocates is to push in the other direction and say, that doesn't go far enough. And here's what I want to see. It's like a permission structure that goes in both ways. One, it's the president saying, we need to pursue this. I would like Congress to pursue this. And that it's a way for advocates to say, we love that you support those things, but here's more that we want to see. It really it's really valuable because it starts that conversation, even if you're the type of person on first blush feels like that's not enough, you know?
No, that's me. I'm it's not enough. We should be much bigger, much bolder, much chunkier, much get in there, get your digits all balled up and take it on. Because, you know, sadly, one of the things I've always said about Democrats is, you know, in a street fight, they'll offer to hold your coat.
That's correct.
And, you know, I want to see, and this is where I'm hoping Kamala Harris, I'm hoping everything that the right says about Kamala Harris is true. I'm hoping she's a pit bull, and I'm hoping she's a fighter, and I'm hoping she goes in there and you know, not literally, but figuratively, you know, crack some heads, get some behinds moving. Because look, there's 100%. A lot of things that are going on that are harming the working class of this country, and working people are struggling because of these decisions coming out of this court. And sadly, the ones I see coming down the road are even worse. Mm-hmm. So if we allow this court to just go completely off the rails and take us back to the days of the Lochner era and worse, we're going to see lots of societal chaos. And I don't want my kids to have to live through that.
I totally understand. I think that's totally right. I think Democrats, as a general rule, have just not worked this muscle, the muscle of holding the court accountable. It's been, I don't know, 100 years since anybody has done, has like passed a court reform, you know what I mean? And so Democrats, for better or for worse, have always thought of the Supreme Court as an institution that expands access to constitutional rights. And so if you were just walking down the street and just went up to a random person and said, can you name a Supreme Court case? Very likely they're gonna say Brown v. Board, right? Which was a case about expanding rights. Roe v. Wade is another case that people can name that was about expanding rights. And so people think of the court as that. And maybe there's some cases we don't agree with, but they're not fundamentally bad. We're in a totally different universe now. This court is not interested in expanding rights. Every major case on voting rights, abortion, schooling has been narrowing that window. And workers' rights is a really good example too, just like you said, narrowing the universe of people who can actually advocate for themselves, access constitutional rights, and enjoy freedoms. This court is not interested in doing that. And Democrats have been very late to pick up on that. And Dick Durbin in particular, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, has been very hesitant to investigate corruption at the Supreme Court, to move ahead legislation that would reform the court. And so this step by the president is kind of, in a way, saying to Dick Durbin, it's okay.
It's a
cattle prod. You can, yes, it is okay to reform the court. Nothing bad is going to happen to you. Because I think as a party, the Democrats have just said, well, if we do big things, we'll lose elections. And that just isn't true anymore. I think if you look at any Democratic governor that's had success over the last 4 years or so of Joe Biden's presidency, it's because they went big. Like if you look at Tim Walz and Gretchen Whitmer and Jay Inslee in Washington State, they went big and they're popular. And so I think that congressional Democrats are finally starting to realize that. And the court reforms, I think, are part of that conversation.
Yeah, it's only something that I've been saying for the last 20 years.
Yeah.
if you're not doing anything, if you don't have bold vision, if you don't have a path towards the future, you're not going to get people to come along. If you're just moderately better than the other side. I think it was Harry Truman said, who, if you have the choice between a Republican and a Democrat that acts like a Republican, they're going to vote for the Republican every time.
Yes. Yes.
So you know, differentiate yourself and have bold ideas. And this is where my problem with this is. So last line of questioning I've got for you, because obviously this isn't going to pass today, tomorrow, the next, in my view, ever. But the organizing that's got to come out of the push to want more of this, to hold our court accountable, much like we want to hold our presidents accountable and the legislative branch accountable. This comes back down to, you know, boots on the ground, knocking on doors, talking to family, friends, all that stuff, the work that you guys do at United for Democracy. So where's your pathway towards success on this?
I know people are sick of hearing this, but you simply must vote. This next 100 days is really about really think about what you want. I mean, I think people haven't, up to this point, haven't totally realized the connection between how you vote and what the Supreme Court looks like. Your senators are the ones who confirm these people to the bench. So if your senator is confirming people like Neil Gorsuch and Brett Kavanaugh and Amy Coney Barrett, that's bad. These are the people who are winnowing down and attacking workers' rights. They are the ones who are voting to overturn abortion. They are the ones who, just like you said, want to bring us back to that Lochner era where the minimum wage is whatever people contract. It could be $0.
Yeah, if you're
people
hungry
are willing
enough,
to work for free, that's not good.
If you're hungry enough and desperate enough to work for poverty wages in deplorable condition, it is your freedom, Megan.
And
it's your liberty.
And this group of people are already showing signs that that's what they're interested in doing, that they're interested in rolling back Congress's ability to protect workers' safety in the workplace, to protect wages, to protect those things, this court is not interested in protecting those things. So that really comes down to who's in control of Congress. Right now, Republicans have the court that they want. Republicans don't even support an ethical code of conduct for Supreme Court justices because they want to be able to reward Supreme Court justices who vote the right way with gifts, with trips, and with the things that we've seen like Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito get in return for having voted a certain way in a case. They don't want an ethics code because they like what they've got, let alone bigger reforms like term limits or court expansion or anything else like that. So you have to think about which party, which may have been disappointing in the past. I'm not here to do PR for Democrats, but
me neither.
But there is a group. There is a group who is interested in reforming the court, and that's what the president's announcement was about. He is interested. Kamala Harris supports this plan too, and they're going to need a Congress who's willing to do the work to make those reforms a reality. And we cannot do it if Republicans have the gavel in either chamber.
There you go. No, it's good stuff, and I hope folks will check out your website, UnitedForDemocracy.us. You are a diverse, how it's reported to me, a diverse coalition shining a spotlight on the ways of the Supreme Court and how it impacts families, communities, freedom, and democracy. So go to UnitedForDemocracy.us. Megan, great talking with you. Appreciate the time. Hope you'll come back and talk to us again real soon.
Anytime. Yeah, thanks.
Megan Hatcher-Mays. Make sure you check out that website, UnitedForDemocracy.us. Going to take a quick break. Right back after this. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Term limits? Yeah? No? Up? Down? Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com. Right back.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW. This is your local Civic Media radio station.
Want to hear even more? Anytime?
Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Mace Michaels. Tonight, mostly cloudy, scattered storms, some could be strong. Warm and muggy with a low in the upper 60s. And a mix of sun and clouds for tomorrow, more storms possible. Not as hot, but still humid, high mid-80s. Heating back up Friday and plenty of humidity, high upper 80s. Right now it's 73.
Hi, this is Jim Schmidt, your former mayor of Green Bay. You know, I've always cared about local issues. I still do. Join me on my new show, Lean Local, here on WGBW. I'll interview community leaders and elected officials, discuss the economy and development projects, and we'll talk about the future of education here in Greater Green Bay. As they say, all politics is local. So join me for Lean Local, Sunday at 1 p.m. on the Talk of Green Bay, 97.9 WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So you go from very positive that this could be a way to save the courts, save our faith in our Supreme Courts, historic lows of approval from we the people, looking at the nine in robes. And here to share some cold water on what could possibly be, and answer the question, why now? I've asked our good friend Ian Millhiser to come share some thoughts. Ian's got a piece over at Vox right now. Biden's new Supreme Court reform proposals are mostly useless. Ian, thanks for taking time for us.
It's good to be here. Thank you, Rick.
That's a bit harsh, don't you think? Useless?
I mean, the way I look at it, I'm a policy reporter. Like, other people can talk about like what the politics are or like what the political fallout of this could be. My job is to look at what would these things actually do if they became law. And the answer to that is not much. These are really modest reforms. And on top of that, you know, Biden proposed three ideas: term limits for the justices, getting rid of the Trump immunity case that was just decided, and then making them have an ethics code. And at least two of those would require a constitutional amendment. And that ain't happening. Like, it's impossible to amend the Constitution. You need three quarters of the states to agree. If there's any meaningful political faction in the country that doesn't want something to happen, you're not going to get a constitutional amendment. And there is a big political faction that doesn't want these to happen. It's called the Republican Party. So, I am happy to see the Democratic Party deciding to go after this court, which has been just awful. You know, I'm happy to see that in an election year, they're realizing that they need to attack the center of Republican power in Washington, D.C., which is the Supreme Court. But the policy proposals themselves, they're meh.
But isn't this is, you know, and as I was thinking about this on Monday when this came out, this is very, very Democrat. this is that, you know, in a street fight, they're offered to hold your coat. And I was hoping that with Kamala Harris, this would maybe change a little bit, because the right-wing message is, you know, she's this attack dog pit bull. So I was hoping for bigger, for bolder, you know, maybe expanding the court to 13 to match the districts. Maybe something that you could really, I don't know, get your teeth into.
Yeah, I mean, part of the problem here is that, like, the way that the Constitution treats the Supreme Court is really weird. Like, you know, maybe I won't use street fight as a metaphor. Maybe I'll use a bar fight as a metaphor. Like, imagine you were in a bar where if you, like, say a nasty word to someone, or if you throw a punch, the bouncer will be on you in a second and throw you out. But if you stab someone, the bouncer is going to be like, okay, that's cool. That is kind of how the Supreme Court, how the Constitution treats the Supreme Court. So term limits, you know, overruling a bad constitutional decision of the Supreme Court, really modest stuff, generally requires it either requires a constitutional amendment, or, like, if you want to overrule a decision, you just have to appoint a bunch of justices who want to overrule it. That's really hard to do. But, like, one thing that you can do like that is court packing. You know, the Constitution gives Congress the power to decide how many justices sit on the Supreme Court. There have been as many as five. There's been as few as five. There's been as many as 10. So Congress could tomorrow, if it wanted to, add like 6 seats to the Supreme Court. Biden could fill them all, and then we'd have a 9-6 Supreme Court. The reason why no one does that, though, is because that completely delegitimizes the judiciary. It invites a tit-for-tat situation where the next time Republicans are in power, they're going to add a bunch of seats, and soon we have dozens of justices, and they're all a bunch of political hacks. So you can do the biggest, most damaging things, you know, the equivalent of stabbing someone in the middle of the bar to the Supreme Court. But if you want to do something sensible and moderate, that's actually not on the table.
Yeah, no, and look, I like the idea that they're talking about doing something, but, like, term limits, that seems to be the rights fetish. And look, I get it for Congress people. I get, you know, you make that argument. I'm against it because I think we have the ultimate term limiter. We can vote the bums out. But the Supreme Court's a whole different scenario. So when you have bad actors, you know, like, and I would argue Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito are bad actors, and they seem to be, appear to be, bought and paid for, there should be a way to usher them along.
Yeah, I mean, I'll confess I have some ambivalence about term limits. I mean, you know, Clarence Thomas has been on the Supreme Court since 1991. That's just a really long time for someone to hold that sort of awesome power. And I mean, I know a lot of judges. A lot of the judges are really great people, but, like, one weird thing about the job of a judge is everyone you encounter in your professional life has to treat you with a kind of ritualized obsequiousness.
Yeah.
You know, it's all Your Honor this and yes, Your Honor that. And, like, if you're arguing a case and a judge, like, disagrees with you, you have to find, like, the most polite way possible to respond. You know, I clerked for a judge. He was a great guy, but, like, I couldn't be in his presence unless I had a suit on, and I had to treat him with an extraordinary amount of deference. And I don't care who you are. Like, after you've lived like that for 20, 30, 40 years, it's just going to mess with your head. Yeah. So, like, I see the argument for term limits. Oh, my dog likes term limits. You can hear it. You can hear him endorsing it. At the same time, like, I don't know that term limits are going to solve the problem of a court that's too partisan or too ideological.
Right.
You know, Reagan's appointees were worse than Nixon's appointees. Bush's appointees were worse than Reagan's appointees. Trump's appointees were worse than Bush's appointees. And if Trump gets a second term, they're going to be worse than the first term appointees. So, like, if you swap out someone like John Roberts, who's very conservative but more moderate than, you know, what Trump is likely to give us, for, you know, another Alito or another Gorsuch, you've just made things worse. You know, there are good arguments for term limits, but I'm not sure that it'll fix this ideological, very partisan court is one of them.
But even if you wanted to do term limits, wouldn't you have to pass? I mean, you're never, admit, we're never getting a constitutional amendment. I don't think I'll ever see one in my lifetime. because I don't think you're ever going to get 290 people in the House and 67 senators to agree on any one thing. And then to throw on top of that, as you pointed out, three quarters of the states to pass it as well. So is there a legislative way to enact, you know, term limits and, you know, and this code of ethics that the Supreme Court justices aren't going to go, no?
Yeah. I mean, term limits, I really don't think there's a way to do it without a constitutional amendment. I mean, the Constitution's pretty clear. It says the justice shall serve during good behavior, which has long been interpreted to mean as long as you don't like commit some egregious form of misconduct, you get to keep your seat. And being old is not misconduct.
Yeah, but being in the pocket of some billionaires, that seems like misconduct.
Yeah, and I mean, the problem is that the remedy is impeachment. And so, yeah, I mean, there's no question that Thomas and Alito should resign. I mean, you shouldn't be allowed to fly around on some billionaire's jet, you know, and then go back to your government job, no matter what that government job is. You know, no other branch of government will tolerate that. But the problem is that the remedy is impeachment. And that means you got to get 67 senators, which, you know, that's the same problem you have with trying to get a constitutional amendment done. I mean, could there ever be a term limits amendment? I don't know. Like, if 30 years from now, like, imagine that, like, Elena Kagan, who's a Democrat, and Amy Coney Barrett, who's a Republican, are still on the court, and they're both senile, and they're handing down, like, just ridiculous, crazy, like, it's a problem that both parties recognize, that you've got these two folks who have stayed on well beyond their competence, and one's a Democrat and one's a Republican. Maybe under those circumstances, I could see a term limits amendment passing. But right now, Republicans have a 6-3 majority. Term limits are a threat to their majority because anyone who's term limited out right now would be replaced by Joe Biden. So, you know, they don't want that to happen. And so, you know, they don't care, you know, if Clarence Thomas loses his marbles tomorrow, they'd rather have a Clarence Thomas who can't remember where he put his house keys over any Democrat.
Right, but isn't the argument, you know, the argument that I heard most recently was that we would like grandfather in these justices, right? So that it would be the new ones, and that there could be a way possibly to get around this by, you know, what was it, rotating them through the circuits, like, because evidently, yeah, you're the expert here. Evidently each justice is supposed to oversee a circuit, which is why the argument for 13 justices actually makes a little bit of sense. But that they would then rotate through that, it sounds convoluted, but I'm sure you've got, yeah, the idea.
I mean, there's an argument for it. I mean, I actually think it's a pretty persuasive argument that you could apply term limits to future justices. The argument is that the specific language that the Constitution uses is that federal judges shall hold their offices during good behavior. And so Congress could change the nature of the office that a new justice is appointed to. They could say, like, you are being appointed permanently to a circuit court, which is a lower court position, and then we are also giving you a temporary assignment of 18 years to the Supreme Court. And so that is the office that you hold. It is a different office than the current justices hold, which is a seat on the Supreme Court for life. And I mean, I think there's a plausible argument that you could sort of get around the Constitution that way and implement an 18-year term limit, or however long you wanted to make it, for future justices. But I mean, first of all, that doesn't solve the problem of the justice that we have right now. And second of all, like, even if you can come, I mean, it doesn't, I mean, you can come up with the argument. I just told you what it is. I think it's a pretty good argument. But the people who have to decide whether that argument flies or not is the Supreme Court. And so, like, if you are a justice who's been appointed to the Supreme Court and they want you to leave and you don't want to leave, all you got to do is get four of your buddies to say you don't have to leave, and then you don't have to leave.
So we have a broken court. And you said, if we're going to solve this problem, there is no solution to this problem, is there then? I mean, we're going to have to live out the and suffer through the pain that's going to come from the bad decisions that are yet to come. Not just the ones that were already decided, but the bad decisions that are yet to come.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there is no solution. I think there are two solutions. I mean, one, the more radical solution is you can pack the court. And I mean, that I think would require extraordinary majorities in favor of it. There'd have to be a widespread national backlash against the Supreme Court. You know, Franklin Roosevelt famously tried to pack the Supreme Court when he was at the height of his popularity. And Franklin Roosevelt was more popular than any modern president has ever been. And he wasn't able to do it. So, you know, it is an extraordinarily heavy political lift. But you can imagine if the court keeps handing down outrage after outrage, you know, imagine a dozen decisions like Dobbs. Imagine a dozen decisions like the Trump immunity decision. Like at some point, you could imagine there being enough of a political backlash that a bill could pass. So that's one option. The other option is just to do it the old fashioned way. You know, justices leave. They die. They retire. You know, they eventually get off the court one way or another. And, you know, how did the Republican Party get rid of Roe v. Wade? Well, they did two things. They organized and like made sure that anyone appointed by a Republican president would oppose Roe v. Wade. And then they just waited for enough justices to rotate off the court at a time when a Republican was in office, and they eventually filled the court with justices that they knew were going to oppose Roe v. Wade. So what I think Democrats need to do is they need to decide what's on the list of cases that they want overruled. You know, I mean, I think certainly the Trump immunity decision should be on it. You know, a lot of these cases giving the court the power to overrule like any federal regulation should be on it. Dobbs should potentially be on it. And then, you know, what the people have to do is just keep electing Democrats to office so that those Democrats can eventually fill the court with enough justices who will take the court in a different direction.
Yeah. Is there that mechanism on the Democratic side? I mean, everyone's giving credit for the current Supreme Court to the Federalist Society and this Leonard Leo guy and all the money that went into creating that environment. Is there anything like that on the other side?
There is. I mean, I think that, you know, the Federalist Society works because the Republican Party is like more homogenous and like more willing to turn things over to, you know, a bunch of rich guys who like mostly support what they want to do. The Democratic Party doesn't work like that, but like, the Democratic Party has a broad consensus that abortion rights should exist. You know, the Democratic Party has a broad consensus that, you know, the Trump immunity decision was wrong. You know, Biden and Harris wouldn't have both come, you know, the sitting Democratic president and the Democratic presumptive nominee wouldn't both have come out in favor of getting rid of the Trump immunity decision if they didn't know that it was unpopular. So, like, you know, I think that the Democratic Party is responsive to, you know, views that are overwhelmingly shared by Democrats. And so, again, you know, it's on all of us. If there are people who, you know, believe that that there's a certain thing that the Supreme Court needs to do and it should be on the list, you know, then we need to organize in favor of it. You know, if you don't like some of the anti-union decisions, then the solution is, you know, unions need to organize and they need to tell Democratic presidential candidates, if you want our vote, this is what your Supreme Court nominees need to support. You know, if you want our endorsement, this is what your Supreme Court nominees need to support. So, I mean, you know, politics only works one way. You organize. And, you know, there is a path forward. You know, it is a slow process. I mean, I'm sure I don't have to tell you or your listeners that, like, organizing to bring about political change isn't something that you could do over the course of a weekend. But is there a path forward? Yes, that's it.
Yeah, and it's not what people want to hear, though, Ian. We live in the fast food society where you drive up to the window, you get the bag, and it's instant gratification. You're talking, you know, how long did it take Republicans to take over the court? How long has this been? 50 years in the making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, Roe v. Wade was on the books for 49 years. And, you know, Republicans started, you know, coalescing around the idea they didn't like Roe v. Wade as recently as the Reagan administration. You know, affirmative action, the Supreme Court's decision saying, I mean, Bakke from the 1970s was a very limited decision. It said that affirmative action was only allowed in very limited circumstances, but that was around for about 50 years. And, you know, Republicans organized, it took them a long time. I don't know that it necessarily has to take 50 years. I think that the Dobbs decision, you know, getting rid of Roe was so unpopular. I think the Trump immunity decision is so unpopular that, you know, especially in the case of the Republican campaign against Roe v. Wade, they were organizing against the will of a majority of Americans. I think it is easier to organize when you have a majority of the people in your favor. But we are talking about a project of many years here. Yeah. And I think, you know, we need to be cognizant of that, that, you know, we are talking about a project that isn't going to be solved by one election, but that can be solved by several elections.
But it starts with one election, and it starts with this election.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Because, and at every election that the Republicans win, they dig us deeper into a hole.
Yeah, and it starts with this election. I mean, because there's the thought that, you know, who knows, in the next term there could be another one or two. I mean, Sotomayor and Kagan aren't getting any younger.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, Clarence Thomas is in his mid-70s. You know, so is Samuel Alito. You know, they are at the age where it would be reasonable to expect they might have to leave the Supreme Court. So, I mean, who knows? Maybe Kamala Harris gets in there, and in her first term, Thomas and Alito have to leave the court. Now we have a 5-4 Democratic court, and it's morning in America again. Like, you know, it could happen very quickly.
I don't wish them any ill. I don't want to go there. Maybe take some of those vacations from Harlan Crow and the billionaires. Maybe do that full time.
Yeah, no, I want to be clear. I wish them both a long and very fruitful retirement where they, you know, they have lovely lives wielding no power over anyone ever again.
There you go. Ian, as always, great stuff. Hope folks will take a look at the article over at Vox. Biden's new Supreme Court reform proposals are mostly useless. Written by Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent there at Vox. Ian, as always, great talking with you, man.
Great talking with you, Rick.
Again, you know, I love the messaging. I love the fact that we should be fighting for something. Just wish it was bolder, little chunkier, little meaner. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1970. That was the day that the NFL Players Association went out on strike. The American Football League and the National Football League officially merged that year. Each league had their own Players Association. With the league merger, they joined forces into one union. The players elected John Mackey, a tight end with the Baltimore Colts, their first president. Frustrated by pay and lack of control over their careers, the players voted to strike. The strike lasted for 2 days. The owners threatened to cancel the season. The NFL used its powerful PR machine to vilify the players in the press. They characterized the players as greedy and stoked fan anger over the walkout. The two sides met again at the bargaining table and reached a collective bargaining agreement. The agreement covered 4 years. The players won improvements to their pensions and dental care. They also secured the right to have agent representation for the first time. But many of the disagreements over pay and control remained unsettled. In 1974, the players were back out on the picket line for 5 weeks during the summer. 8 years later, a 57-day strike disrupted the season. 7 weeks of games were canceled. Then again, 5 years later, the union went on strike during the season. This time, some of the players crossed the picket lines, including stars like Joe Montana and Lawrence Taylor. This broke the strike without settling on a contract. Today, the NFL Players Association continues to push for improved player safety and revenue sharing. The impact of concussions on players' long-term health remains an important issue for the union.
Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this story over at Meta. I've tried to delete a Facebook page. It's darn near impossible. But Meta CEO Zuckerberg, during some SIGGRAPH event on July 29th, said that the potential for AI is to help people, especially creators, help them do more, not less. And he said that what the vision is they're going to help people digitally simulate their personalities and their businesses online so that, you know, you could eventually have your own, you could clone yourself to do all your work for you. You could, you know, you could have, you know, a you who goes to digital work, and then you get to go play or do. I'm guessing this is the idea. Now, as I was thinking of this, you know, my mind went to, okay, you're going to clone yourself. You're going to make like a digital twin, not clone. You're going to have like a digital twin, and it's going to have your personality. It's going to respond as you would respond to things. And I started thinking about it, going, is this a good thing? I mean, what if I don't like my digital twin? What if I don't like it? What if I don't like my personality on my digital twin? Can I change it? Or am I stuck with this now digital me? It's a weird kind of thing. But oddly enough, you know, brought to us by Zuckerberg. And I guess this is the brave new world. This is the future. We're going to have digital relationships with ourselves. Weird. And finally, I got to talk about this story. ProPublica had put out an article on Trump's media company. And, you know, we've heard a lot from the right about, you know, Joe Biden and Hunter Biden and, you know, all of this claims of malfeasance, of corruption, of, you know, all of this stuff that supposedly happened, which is odd because Republicans have had the House and have done a very poor job of really investigating any of this or coming with any concrete evidence. Lots of smoking water pistols, but no real evidence. But ProPublica reports that Trump's media company, you know, the Truth Social thing, evidently wants to start streaming, you know, like television, like kind of like Twitter does. I guess they want to start streaming longer videos or TV on their Truth Social so that, you know, it's like a one-stop shop for everything Trump, I guess. And as ProPublica pointed out, there are a number of groups that want to buy into this, and a number of technology firms. But one of them that wasn't mentioned in the press release was this JedTech LLC, which was mentioned in the securities filings. Now, when they did some digging and they found out who was behind this JedTech, it's a Louisiana energy magnate, a guy named James Davidson. Most people have never heard of James Davidson, but he's a huge Republican donor. He's got massive influence in Louisiana and on the federal level because he's got a lot of money. And he spreads it around a little bit, makes sure that, you know, people who, you know, make sure that people who need it get it. And of course, when he needs something. But this situation makes you wonder about a business relationship that Trump is in with a big Republican donor funding part of this Truth Social thing. Seems a little cozy. Now, I forgot the main part. I forgot the uncozy part. The part is that they want to stream TV on the Truth Social. So they went to a company who you would think streams TV, right? I mean, if you're going to buy in, if you're going to send money, if you're going to invest, you're going to have something, right? I mean, that's how I think about it. If I'm going to invest in you and I have a business that I want to make money off of, clearly I'm going to want to have some kind of back and forth. According to ProPublica, this JedTech has virtually no public footprint, has no website, and they don't know if they even stream anything. So it's one of these things where you go, hold on, seems a little cozy, and it seems a little, well, fraudulent? I mean, just from the outside, from reading this ProPublica article. And knowing that the guy behind it is a rich billionaire who funds Republican politicians, this seems like another way to get around campaign finance laws, another way to enrich someone like Trump, to curry favor. So for me, I think somebody, and fortunately ProPublica did a piece on this, but maybe someone should be, I don't know, paying attention to this, looking into it, and a lot of this. Because you got to imagine, the graft is pretty high. Anyway, if you missed any of today's program, grab the podcast wherever you get your favorite podcast. You'll find ours. You want to check out the video, freespeech.org, where you go for that. And as always, email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.